Barry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, we're living now and we're all in this place, so be sure to smile.
Good afternoon. This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stosh Zielkowski.
And you are listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour on enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. We are community-based internet radio, and we are glad you're with us today. We have, aside from Andy Offutt-Irwin that you just heard singing Tarry Here, and thanks to Andy for letting us use that to open our show and almost every show on Mondays at 12 noon, we have another special person with us this morning. Can you say good morning, Kevin?
Good morning, Kevin.
Well, except now it's afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sorry to confuse you. It just became afternoon. Kevin's, of course, another storyteller. And I'm going to let Kevin tell us about his storytelling for a little bit before we move on. We have all kinds of things planned for this afternoon, but let's start by making sure you know who the famous Kevin Cordy is.
Well, thank you very much. Story is very important, and I started out as a story listener. And it's wonderful to be here in West Virginia because I was raised on West Virginia stories. To this day, the resident storyteller in my house is my mother and used to be my father. And we'd sit on a dilapidated old couch with five brothers and sisters. And my mother would turn off the television and she'd say, "You're not getting up until you hear this story." And we would go to worlds that were in Clay County, West Virginia, and my dad outside of Morgantown. And I fell in love with stories. And every day I'd hear something new. My mother, one day she said, "Yeah, you're Aunt Bertha." I don't know if they didn't have childhood toys, but one day there was an old a log, and they played this crazy game. They brought in all the neighborhood kids, and she had a hatchet, and they put their fingers on this log. And I don't know, I mean, I'd rather be playing checkers, but they'd sit there and, you know, that game with the knife and you go through the fingers, well, they'd go back and forth and back and forth. And I don't know, they played this a few times. And one day my mother sat there on that old porch or on that couch and she said, "And one day if somebody wasn't paying attention and poof, four fingers gone." I said, "Mom, that can't be true. There's no way that's true. It couldn't happen." She said, "Now you listen to me." She said, "We're going tomorrow. You need to get in the station wagon, a yellow Ford station wagon, 1977. And she said, "I'm going to drive down the road, and I want you to watch me. And you pay attention when your mom says that." So I got in the car, and she rolled down the window to one of our neighbors. And she said, "Hey, Louise." And she waved. And that person waved back with just a thumb. And I realized then that truth is a story and that I fell in love with listening to stories. But then I was a story listener and I realized that I was listening to the stories of West Virginia. At one point, I thought the only states were West Virginia and Ohio because that's the only we traveled once for 2 weeks once a year. And that was the only place we went. But every day I was able to go to story. And a long story short, which I can't do here, I became the first full-time high school storytelling teacher in the country. I traveled 11 years with a teenage group of storytellers called Voices of Illusion. I started a program called Voices Across Storytelling in the World for youth, and we had 183 youth storytelling clubs across the country and registered in Japan. And I really believe in the power of story. I think it's what we can really, really take home. And it's a longer story to this question, but at least that gives you a sense of my West Virginia roots.
That was a perfect answer to the question.
Wonderful.
Wow. Those are the only two states you need, Ohio and West Virginia.
Well, you know, if I'm performing in California, they might disagree with you. Okay. But my roots are in Appalachia.
Thank you, Kevin. Boy. Okay, great introduction. Stosh.
Yes.
Do you think it's time for you to talk about the past week or not? Just say.
Well, the past week has been wonderful. Mostly starting with Saturday.
Well, that is the first
because
day of the week,
weekend,
right?
Lots of parades around in the area, but Saturday, Kevin showed up at my house after a long drive, and since he appeared, we have had lots of fun talking and sharing stories back and forth, and to my wife's delight, she and Kevin get along very well, and so on Sunday, we went to Hagerstown, to the home of the famous Jose and Fanny Crawford, and there was a workshop conducted by Kevin, and we had a wonderful time. Lots of learning, lots of sharing, and lots of learning to listen and respond, and that's my week.
A little bit of play.
It was a good bit of play.
Well, and I just learned this morning that it might possibly develop that there could be a session two of that workshop. So
that would be wonderful.
Stay tuned to hear more about that.
I've already signed up.
So have I.
There you go.
I'm going to talk real briefly about stories in the round, and then I'm going to ask Kevin if he's willing to tell us a story. So let's get some of this important housekeeping work out of the way. This evening, Kevin is our special storytelling guest at Stories in the Round, and that's, of course, at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike, which is Salem Avenue Extended, if you're familiar with Hagerstown at all, 7 p.m. this evening. And if you'd like more information about that session, you can contact me by calling me at 301-730-1638, or you can email me at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. And you are going to want to be there this evening. We already have a good crowd coming, so call early if you're interested in coming, because we want to make sure you get a seat. Next month, in June, we have Andy Offit Irwin coming for the second time to Stories in the Round. He was here last summer, and he told Sister True, which is a wonderful story of, understanding, getting to understanding, and figuring out where you came from and where you're going. And Andy has promised to follow up on that story, on some of those same themes this time. That's June 18th, coming up also at 7 p.m. And same deal, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, or email me to get more information, get your tickets in advance. And then in July, we have Magid Melvin Medlitz. Magid is a ordained rabbi telling stories in the sacred traditions of Judaism. And I know Magid Melvin Medlitz from far, far back in my childhood, but now he's a whole new guy. He's reinvented himself. And I'm learning to know him as Magid. So you want to come out and hear him tell sacred stories as well. And on and on and on till December. But we're not going to go month by month right now. We're going to hear a story, I hope, from Kevin Cordy, the best storyteller in the world, because he's here telling stories right now.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, it takes a lot to put a program like this together. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes the organization. But most of all, and some of the programs that we just heard about, it takes heart. And so in that spirit, I'm going to tell this story. So I'm going to invite your listeners to just look at their hands right now, including the people in this room, and listen to the story. They say we were born with our hearts in our hands. A long time ago, we were born with our hearts in our hands. Go ahead and look at them. That one point, there was a heart shape within the context of your hand. There was a red heart, and some had a blemished heart, and some would have lines in their hearts, and some would have scrapes on their hearts, and they would raise them high, and they would wave to people, and they'd say hi, and people could see the hearts, and they would be happy, and they would laugh, and it would bring joy, and it would bring laughter, and people loved showing their hearts, until he came to town. He came in and he raised his hand as high as he could, and he said, "Look at my heart. Look at it. Look at it. Have you not seen anything more perfect? It is red. It is amazing. It is heart-shaped. Look at it. It has no lines, no blemishes, no tears. No, it is amazing. Have you not?" And people were in awe, and they said, "Oh, that's amazing. Look at that." And he said, "Let me see your heart." And he looked, and there would be a blemish, and he'd say, "That's hardly a heart at all. Put it away. I don't want to see it. Cast not on my eyes. Oh, my gosh. Let me see your heart. Oh, I would hide under the bed forever if I ever had that hand as a heart." And people started to turn their hands only facing themselves so they could see their heart. And he would walk into the town, and he would go to little children that were in the line at recess, and he'd say, "Do you want to see my heart?" And he'd say, "It will cost you your lunch money." And people would fight, and they'd bicker back and forth, and who got to see the hand? And he'd look, and he'd say, "Look at it shine. It's beautiful beyond compare." And the kids would be like, "Yes," and they would fight to get in line, and people literally hit themselves in the face so that they could stand into the rightful place to see the hand. And he'd give them shorter times. You could only see it for 20 seconds. You, because you have such a hideous hand, can only see it for 5 seconds. And he went from town to town doing his duty. And he would go from this town. And one particular one, he went to every person that he could talk to. And he said, "This is my heart." And people no longer waved. They nodded their heads. There was less laughter. There was less conversation. There was less heart. And he thought that he had done his duty and he was done in the town. And so he went to walk away, and he saw one woman coming in from the fields, an older woman. And he said, "Hey, you, old woman, I need to talk to you." "Yes, hold on a minute, son." "No, I need to talk to you now. I'm about to leave, and I'm going to give you a gift among gifts." "Well, that's nice that you think you have a gift among gifts. I wait till I get there. I've just come back from the fields, and the fields don't take care of themselves." "Old woman, hurry. Be quick in the pace. You'll be glad that you're here. You can talk about this for years and years upon years. Your children will want to hear you spellbound by what you see today." "Well, I guess I'll try to quicken my pace, but a cane only moves so far. It does not move as fast as your speech." "Old woman, come here, please." "What is it that you have, young man, that you so patiently are telling me about?" "Said, I have a beautiful thing to share with you. I have the most beautiful heart that you ever seen." "Is that right?" "Yes, it is right. It is true. It is 100% authentic and accurate. Do you want to see it?" "Well, I wouldn't mind. I have a little bit of time to rest before I need to go out to the fields again." "Well, okay. It'll cost you $5. "I haven't got $5. "What do you mean?"
Young man, I work the fields. I make what I can. I provide for my family. And I don't have time. And I don't have money to look at what I can't afford. Old woman, I can tell you need a gift more than anything. So I'll give you the gift that you can share with your family's family. Look at my hand. Have you not seen anything more perfect in all the lands and all the people that you've met? And he looked down and he looked down and he saw, and he, like a mirrored reflection, he saw that his heart was red as the sun was often red. That it was heart-shaped and it didn't have a blemish or a tear. And the old woman took the hand and looked at it and said, giving it back, "It's very nice, dearie. Now the fields don't take care of themselves." He was used to people oohing and ahhing. He said, "Old woman, do you not need to see that again? I didn't hear any exclamation except for 'That's nice.' It's more than nice. Are you going blind, woman?" "I don't know what you want to hear, what you need to hear." "Old woman, I need not hear anything. You're the one who needs to hear. You need to see. I may let you cheat. I charge people double to look twice. I need you to look at it again. Look at it again." And he said, "Look, look." And he looked at it. And he was reminded of how beautiful his heart was, and how it had not a blemish or a tear or a rip. And he said, "Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that you had a gift." He said, "Old woman, is this not the most beautiful heart that you've ever seen in your life?" She took a breath. "Dearie, no, it is not." "What do you mean it's not? I don't understand. Who could have a more beautiful heart than me?" "Well," and the old woman said, "me."
"What? You? How, what? Let me see it. I need to—"
"There's no way. That's impossible. Are you daft, old woman? There's no way. You've earned the right, the honor, the prestige, the allegiance. How? What? Can I see it?" "Now, you want to see my hand?"
"Yes, I need to see it now."
"It'll cost you $20. Just kidding." And with that, she reached over and she showed her hand. And it wasn't heart-shaped at all. In some places it was bright red. In some places it was not so bright red. There was a tear and a blemish and even a piece missing. And that man looked at it and he laughed. Laughed in a way that made you feel like he was a bully, because perhaps he was. And he said, "Old woman, I've seen hearts and hands for years and years to come. And there's nothing more hideous than the one that you own. If I were you, I would hide and I would separate myself from that hand, throw it in an embankment or a river or someplace that nobody could find it. It has not any prestige or value." And she said, "Perhaps, but maybe you should see it with my eyes. For you see over here where it's not so red, you see it? That's where we lost the farm. You see over here where it is so red? That's where my sons worked so hard and got back a piece of. And over here where it's cut, over here, it's missing just a little bit. There's a cut. That's where I lost my son in the war. And over here, where there's a piece missing, that's where I gave my heart to someone and didn't ask. Now, dearie, Son, the fields don't take care of themselves. I need to go now. It's been interesting. And she began to walk on. That man, he looked at his hand perhaps for the first time in a long time. And he said, "Oh, ma'am. Ma'am, do you have a moment? I know you have to work the fields, but do you just have a moment? I need to speak with you." And he looked at his hand, and he tore off a piece, and he handed it to her. He said, "You know, the fields don't work themselves. We've got a lot of work to do together. Show me the way." It took a long time. That man left that town, helped her for a while before leaving. And people slowly realized that they could laugh again. They raised their hands, they smiled, they laughed, they had conversation. But from that day to this day, their hands remain where they are, but their hearts remain in their chest. So it takes extra time to see it. It takes time to have a conversation. It takes time to listen. It takes time with generosity and compassion to really hear what someone has to say when they're using their heart.
Wow. That was wonderful, Kevin.
Thank you.
That was just truly wonderful. Ay, ay, ay. That doesn't sound like I appreciated it, but I did very much. I was thinking, ay, 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 boy, I'd love to be able to tell a story like that.
Sure.
So that was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just wonderful. And along the way, I had no clue.
Oh, good.
You know,
I mean, a good story is one that you can't predict, but you're still invested.
Yes, you know? I was definitely invested. And just wonderful. The images that your words caused to appear in my mind were very intense. I like the old lady.
I tend to like her every time I meet her.
Yes.
I see her differently. And she's stronger every time I tell that story. Yeah,
that was good. That was just wonderful.
You channel her so well.
I appreciate
your, your voice in each character. It's really...
Well, I think I should do a station ID, if I could get the words out of my mouth. You're listening to Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, community-based internet radio at enlightenradio.org in Bolivar, West Virginia. And today is Memorial Day. If you're out and about, you're going to run into a parade. So be sure you know how to get out of town or get into town if you have to leave or come in.
Or stay and watch the parade.
Or stay and watch the parade. That's right. And if you have a little radio near you, you could tune into enlightenradio.org.
Well, all you need is a little technical device, digital device.
Thank you for that correction, Fanny.
I'm sorry. Sorry. That was my mother just piped right up and had to tell you that.
That's okay. Well, so we have just heard an example of Dr. Kevin Cordy performing a story, probably one of at least five or six that he knows.
I'm up to seven.
Up to seven. And of course, that's an attempt at humor. I'm sure that there will be a number of zeros behind those numbers.
Maybe. It's what's most important is that you tell the story that someone needs, not that the number that you have.
Well, I think you hit the spot there. Oh. I felt like I needed that. It was wonderful. So, Fanny, do you have any questions for Kevin, since this is to be an interview?
Oh, yeah. That's right. We're supposed to interact on this program.
There you go.
Well, I'm a little bit blown away by that story. I'm really interested in, more on that later. Right now, I think I want to hear a little bit about where Kevin came from. Not any particular story, but I want to know about that little guy, Kevin, and how Kevin grew up to be this amazing storyteller that's here with us today. Dynamic stories, story advocate, story educator, play advocate. Tell me about that other Kevin and how you got here.
You know, when you're 17, you have to fill out a bubble test that tells you what to be for the rest of your life. And I couldn't find what I wanted to be on that paper. And it was a disc jockey. Back then, Casey Kasem and Rick Dees were spinning tunes.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was going to Kent State University, and I found a button that's a slot there that said communications educator. Didn't know that meant being a teacher, but I bubbled it anyway. And I went in, and I started studying to be a teacher and certified. And I asked, I said, so how much is a disc jockey make anyway? He said, well, unless you're Casey Kasem, you're making $3.35 an hour. I thought, maybe I should explore something else. But I also, you know, had the value of being a teacher. And they were having, at Kent State University, they were having a conference. It's called the Once Upon a Time Storytelling Conference. And I thought, did they hire my mom? Because it's the only storyteller I knew. And so I got there, and I said, okay, I'll go in. I was a beat reporter for the Kent Stater, and I walked in and I said, well, I'll be in 10 minutes and then I'll leave and I'll write the story up. And I got there and there was this tall, lanky guy, and he stood in front of ancient people, and they were like 40 and 50 and 60, and I was 18. So I know, crazy.
Old folks.
I know. I didn't even know they survived that long back then. It was crazy. And this tall, lanky guy, he looked over and he said, oh, let me tell you about the little people. They're so small that even a thimble couldn't be their home. And I'm like, oh, what are these people? And he began telling about the fairy folk, and it was Bat Burns from Ireland. And all of a sudden, Rebecca Hill came up, and she was an Appalachian clog dancer, which I thought was something in a sink, but but it was dancing. And I would tell the person I reported to for the reporter, I said, there's something here. I need to stay. And so I would beg, and I begged for a week to stay, and I watched how these ancient people became compassionate and told their stories, and everybody had a story, and they traded Kleenexes to laughter, and then they left. And I was story struck and story starved. And for a year and a half, I learned stories through Cleveland Public Radio's old tapes, which only had their names on it, of Jackie Torrance, the folk tales, Jay O'Callaghan, Donald Davis. And I would mimic what was on the tape. And I remember by then I would graduate, and I'd be in my first year of teaching, and I'm still looking for a storytelling community. And it was one of the hardest things to be a storyteller through audio tapes. And it was painful, to be honest with you. And so I learned that Jackie Torrance, the legendary, was coming to Oberlin. And I called up and I said, look, I'm a teacher and I want to see Jackie Torrance. And they said, we're sold out. I said, no, you don't understand. This is my first year of teaching. I don't miss for anything. I'm going to play hooky. I need to go see Jackie Torrance. I've been listening to her tape. I have no idea what she looks like. I just know that the tape broke and I need somebody to listen to know where Jackie Torrance is. He said, well, it is sold out, but did you say you live by the airport? I said, yeah. She said, we need someone to sit with Jackie for 3 hours. So I sat with Jackie. And she was like a warm celebration birthday party all in one. She made me feel so invited. And like I was her guest. And it was amazing. And she told me beautiful things and real things about the storytelling connection and how it moved her, and the story she was currently working on. And I learned that it's a practice, and I was able to, through being there and finding the Cleveland Storytelling Guild, but I was still one of the youngest storytellers that was out there, and eventually became one of the youngest national touring storytellers, because I was 20, and they were ancient people. And now I'm an ancient person, evidently. But so, long story short, I fell in love with the idea of story but story's also a discipline. And I kept the world of storytelling and my teaching separate because I thought I can tell when I'm not teaching. But I realized by accident, I'm not the king of discipline. I read Lee Cantor's books and all this assertive discipline, and it's just not in me. But I would say six simple words or seven simple words, and it was this: let me tell you a story. And it was the discipline. It was the thing that brought attention. We would do Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and I thought everybody would know more about British literature than I did. My students didn't care. But they did when you couched it in story. When we did pastoral love poetry in a drive-in theater and they were talking back and forth, it was different. When we did the Canterbury Tales as the Brunswick Tales in Ohio, it was different. So now I had students coming in and they would come into my door and they'd say, oh, I'm really nervous about this American Lit. And they'd say, who are you? And I'd say, Mr. Cordy. And they'd say, oh, you're the storytelling teacher. I'll be okay. I've heard about you. Because story is a comfort. Story can instigate and agitate, but it's a comfort. And so I learned to listen, deeply listen to all the storytellers. I started a youth storytelling group. We traveled. But still, I need to resonate that my mother is the resident storyteller of the family, and I still learn so much from her to this day.
You are the best storyteller in the world. Thank you, Kevin.
Sure.
My gosh.
3 hours with Jackie Torrance.
3 hours with Jackie. Amazing. And, you know, the two things that she came out, she said, you don't listen to the politics of storytelling. You listen to the storytelling of storytelling. And she said what I said earlier. She said, I meet people that have hundreds of storytelling. Literally, Kevin, they take out a list and they show me the storytellers, the stories they know. And she said, I just want to know one thing. Do you have the story that person needs right now at this time? And that's why tonight I'm going to arrive early, hopefully.
Yes.
And I'm going to listen. And that's what's going to determine what I need to tell. I got some ideas, but I'm going to arrive early and I'm going to leave late. Because the good storytellers, the ones that can have the time, stay, because story moves story. Story takes you to another place. And story reminds us of all kinds of places. So the greatest compliment is someone coming up to me and saying, hey, I like that story. I told a veteran story, and it was an amazing story about a friend that I knew from World War II. And this guy came in as though he'd never given anyone any feedback. And he said, that's a good story, but we didn't use M1 rifles at that time. And it was wonderful, because now I could change the story. And I gave him space to say, this is how I can compliment your story.
Oh.
I was thinking that 3 hours with Jackie Torrance, I'm kind of stuck.
I would be too.
When you were that age and Jackie was performing on the national level, would be worth a small fortune.
Very much so.
Or maybe even a large fortune.
And that's why we need to remember to give back. You know, I started the Youth Educator Storytelling Special Interest Group with the National Storytelling Network. And honestly, and people don't remember this, but I do. A long time ago. And that sounds like a story. A long time ago. There was a time when I could base two camps when I approached people about youth storytelling. That some of the top tellers would say, they can't do it. And the others, there were some that said, we don't need the competition. And honestly, some of those same tellers, because it was just an unknown variable, are the biggest advocates for youth storytelling. It's just, it was new. It was different. And so it speaks true to the new movements like the moth or like in Ireland, they have the moth and the butterfly, fairy tales and personal tales together. Mm. Or, you know, people being trained by myths or new traditions. There's new storytelling coming up, but we need to look behind us and say, are you coming up and can I help you on that way? Because it is so important to look in front and behind, because with story comes responsibility to help the next teller coming forward.
Thank you for for taking that responsibility and sharing of yourself and so many wonderful experiences. Kevin, can we get you to do a station ID?
No, I'd love
for
to.
Us?
Yes.
Whoa.
And since I'm, you know, a practitioner of play, I'm going to play around with it.
Uh-oh. Look out.
All right. Yes, it's true. You are listening to the Enlightened. Enlightened, you need to be there. Imagine sitting there hearing stories, Radio Storytelling Hour, with your storytelling host, Fanny and Stash. And here, I just lost my place, so we're going to go again. here we are. Oh, this is Kevin Cordy with your featured storyteller today. Oh, I'm just butchering this up, ain't I?
This is wonderful.
I told you I would play.
This is play.
And this is what story's about. It's about listening and doing and redoing, and it's a story-making process. So here, let's go for broke. It's true. This is Kevin Cordy, your feature storyteller today on The Enlightened. Think about those words, enlightened, because after you listen, it will have a rich resonance. On The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, May 28th, 2018, with your regular co-host, Stash and Fanny, community-based internet radio at enlightenedradio.org in West Virginia. And
for posterity.
For thanks. Posterity. And so tune your ears, play on, tell on, listen. You owe yourself this time to listen to the rich value of storytelling in the Enlightened Hour.
Woohoo!
We
will
should
be
have
using
that.
That.
Oh, we did record.
Oh, good. Okay. Very good.
So that we could maybe we'll use that again.
Right. We definitely
feel free.
Will.
So, at this time, I'd like to do an update on the Speak Story series in Shepherdstown, West
Virginia.
I've
heard great things.
This is the 6 seasons for Speak Story, and this month, coming up on, actually next month, coming up on June 12th, Scott Whitehair,
great
Chicago,
storyteller.
From Chicago, wonderful storyteller, and he tells some personal tales, and Kevin can vouch for Scott because he knows him.
You know, if it's Chicago, he's in the storytelling movement. He started a thing called This Much Is True. Mm-hmm. He produces, I think, like 15 different programs, and he really is attuned to listening to what story is about from all walks of life. Scott Whitehair is amazing.
That's great. And July 10th, Dovey Thomason.
Oh, another man.
One of the great storytellers from the Native American tradition. And Dovey is going to do a program whose title is How the West Was Spun.
I love it.
So we're going to get to hear some of the true tales of the West, not the John Wayne version. And in August 14th, Corrine Stavish. Mm-hmm. Her program is going to be stories about the people of Denmark and how they saved many of the Jewish citizens during World War II. The title of her program is When Good People Do Something. I'm really looking forward to that. September 11th, Donald Davis will be in town.
I've heard of him.
Yes. Donald performs a few times a year and is regarded as one of the best storytellers and certainly is one of the most active storytellers. I don't think you could check Donald's list any day and not find that he's working that week and travels the country. October 9th, Linda Gorham. Mm. She's going to tell some tales with twists and unconventional humor. Whew. My tongue got twisted around my eye teeth. I couldn't see what I was saying. November 13th, Megan Wells.
Wow.
Old Tales and Classical Literature. And in December, Elizabeth Ellis will be back. Elizabeth's program was snowed out in March, and she will be back to entertain and possibly to do the short workshop for the public, which she had intended to do until the snowstorm hit. I did have a recent letter from Elizabeth, and she mentioned she's coming back in December and said it might snow again. Well, it's just a comment. Yes. So that's the lineup for Speak Story.
And that's an amazing lineup.
Get information at speakstoryseries.com on the internet. And there's a place where you can ask questions, and there are phone numbers there where you can call. So now on to other things, which would be another question from Fanny.
Oh.
I'm really good at passing the question.
There you go.
I bet you have some questions of your own, Stosh. But you gave us a great rendition, Kevin, of how you got to be the grown-up Kevin the storyteller, Kevin the...
In quotes.
Well, I've seen you be grown-up, actually.
Yeah, true. Okay.
I've seen you play even as a grown-up. You're a great
play
role model
of being
for that.
Grown up. We need to remember that.
Yeah.
I do have a question.
Uh-oh.
What is a destination on your wish list?
I'm going to have an opportunity, as long as I clear it with the university I'm at, I've been invited to go to China and spend a week in China. I'm really looking at doing more peace mediation through storytelling. In China, I'm just going to work on helping people with culture and story, kind of like a camp for people from 7 to 17. But about 2.5 years ago, I went to Qatar in the Middle East. And people often believe the headlines in a newspaper about a country or a region or a place before they meet the people or talk to them about their stories. There's a Croatian saying that's from Dan Ketting's grandmother that you can't hurt someone once you know their story. And so I think about the weight of those, and I think about how important it is that we look at stories of social justice. And I work with the Southern Law Poverty Center in teaching tolerance, and I want to really reach out and find stories of equity and stories that really help people. I'm working on them now. And so I want to carry that. But as far as the destination, it doesn't have to be an international destination. I love the time I was in Harlan, Kentucky. I love the time that I was in Farmington, New Mexico. And I think a place, I've always said this, is only as strong as the storytelling around it or the stories that are told about it. Like right now, I'm in a Civil War stories and legacies. And if I look around, I can see placards and memorials. I want to be able to explore. At one point, I wanted to just research the untold stories of American heroes and heroines. And I want to really just develop those stories of social justice.
That sounds great.
That reminds me of a author that's near and dear to my heart. You mentioned... when you were talking about play, you mentioned Vivian Gusson Paley yesterday, also from Chicago. And she is one of my favorite people, partly because I grew up in the early childhood community.
Oh.
And Vivian's one of those people who reminds us that play is what it's all about, not only if you're a child, but if you're an adult as well. And talking about the linkage between play and storytelling is something we don't hear enough about, and bringing people together in shared experiences, that storytelling is the next best thing to becoming someone else. Getting immersed in someone else's story may be the closest you can come to walking in someone else's shoes. And I wanted to hear more about that from you. I'll just be quiet and let you do that.
No worries. I have the honor of being on a video series with Vivian Gusson Paley. And Vivian Gusson Paley really said, you can't say you can't play, and you can walk in and you can explore children's play and learn from it and engage them in play. And one of the differences, though, sometimes is that in my work as an adult, I go inside that world of play. So let me talk about the other people that I've studied under, which is Dorothy Heathcote, who is absolutely amazing. She's no longer with us, but she brought in a philosophy or an entire pedagogy of mantle of the expert. So imagine that you're a coal miner, or you're at a kindergarten classroom, and instead of saying, kids, we're going to study coal mining, you put on a mantle of an expert lens, and you say, we're going to study coal mining as though you were coal miners. Or we're going to study because we're going to make a children's book. And she says you have to pull out an enterprise. So I went to the Cleveland School for the Arts, and I told them the story. I do a thing called ensemble storytelling, which is a merger between play and story and story making. And so I sat there and I told them my grandmother looked at me once in Clay County and she said, your uncle died on that great big boat. I think it was famous. I said, what are you talking about, Grandma? And so I went to my aunt. I said, what's she talking about? And my first aunt said, don't pay no mind. And I said, my grandmother doesn't lie. I need to know what this is. So my Aunt Ollie, she said, yeah, your great uncle died on the Titanic. And I started telling them about this story. And then we moved inside the drama, and I looked at these teenagers, and I said, oh, I know you've all come from all walks of life, and that you're ready as reporters to explain. We've got reporters coming in, and you're all engineers. I don't know what your particular engineer specialty is, but I know you had something to do with building the Titanic. And we have to explain ourselves in the next 10 minutes about why it went down. And the next student said, well, I'm an iceberg specialist. And let me tell you about how the water freezes. And the other person, I remember, she said, I left the window open. Do you think that contributed? And we studied and we moved ourselves inside the drama world, and I became the story mediator. But the thing is, as a storyteller, I want to go beginning, middle, end. I want to go for a full story, but here's the deal. We undermine sometimes the power of storytelling as storytellers when we don't see it as an educational practice and pedagogy. So all of a sudden, we went from the Titanic where I wanted to build empathy for Captain John Smith, and I said, Captain John Smith is with us now, and he's having trouble. As you walk by, tell Captain John Smith just a few words. And they said, you're not at fault. And one person laughed. And so I changed the scene so that they're at church, and that Captain John Smith's wife was telling about all the things that Captain John Smith did before the Titanic. And that same person who laughed at Captain John Smith said, there's answer in prayer. And I was able to change through positions of power where students can use story and drama to put on the mantle of the expert and walk into the world. I did this with the chocolate bar bomber in World War II. I did it with Jim and the Giant Beanstalk, where Jack had to go up and see Jim, but he had to steal the coins because his mother was needing help from an illness in the hospital, so he had to decide whether he'd be a thief or not again. And we had all the complications, but the thing is, I never assigned a role. We let the fiction emerge, like Vivian, Gus, and Paley. We let them play, but as the adults, we entered the play in higher roles and lower roles. And I studied with Brian Edmondson, who studied with Dorothy Heathcote for 5 years, and he wrote a book called Imagine to Play. And every day, I spent the world in a fictional world, really learning how much as educators. Imagine we're working with mathematical proofs, and we move inside the world of building a house with those proofs. Imagine that we are talking about gravity and we're Isaac Newton, or we're looking at a historian. When my social studies teacher said, William Howard Taft was so fat it took 6 people to get him out of the bathtub. And then creating that world. It's amazing when we allow students to have agency to be something else and to play. And as adults, we need to remember the practice of play is the work of story.
Kevin, just listening to you right now, listening to the cadence of your voice, listening to your word choices, and thinking about you with these students, these images you're creating of your students, whether they're kids, whether they're adults, getting thoroughly engaged in these worlds you can create with words, with language, with images. And yesterday in your workshop, I could hear you making up or improvising words on the spot. And you wouldn't even comment on the process most of the time. It just seems like these magical words come out of your mouth that are either amalgamations of, I can see you've put different words together, or you're making the words fit your meaning instead of the other way around. Now, did I just make this up, or are you consciously doing this, or is it? It seems so integral to your worldview.
So I've got a friend at Kent State University. He got his doctorate in philosophy, and he specialized in language. And he looked at me with all seriousness, Bill Welton, and he said, who's a Plato specialist as well, and he said, Kevin, I've spent years studying if language came before thought, and I thought I had the answer until I met you. Honestly, I immerse myself in the language and the environment of the people that I have, and my good friends call them Cordianisms, that I have my own unique language. But honestly, it's a colorful language. It's language of image. It's language of non-restriction. It's language of reaction from what I see and do. And I look at life through a story lens. I'm a narrative person, and I don't just do narrative on a performance stage, but I'm constantly rethinking the way that I do in story. And that includes poetic language, that includes metaphor, because those are the tools of story. And honestly, I mean, if you're just talking to me about the coffee that I'm making, I'm probably going to play with the language, because language is the way that we use play. Whether it's conscious or unconscious, it's deliberate in the sense of it is my meaning-making, shaping process of reaction. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does when you say it.
But I think we need to spend more time realizing what we say in the condition and the couch of who we say it with, because everything we do is situational, contextual, political, and social. And we need to respond by recognizing all those. In this context, these words would make something mean even more. And the more you do that, the more it becomes part of the reflex of how you answer and resolve. I'm not that short answer person. I can be, but I'm also the person that loves language connected to making meaning.
So this evening, you're going to be telling stories and making meaning at Stories in the Round in Hagerstown at 7 p.m. Do you already know what is going to come out of your mouth when you get there, or are you going to make it up on the spot?
Before I go, I usually have a tapestry of, I always tell something new in every show that I do. And new might be I've only told it once, or I've told it two times, or I'll play. I'm not ever going to tell the story the same way twice. So even the ones that I've been telling for a while, I'm going to change it. And I'm more responsive than many tellers that I see to the audience. I literally do breathing exercises and have my student or have my audiences breathe with me, whether they know it or not. I'll say, "Join with me as we go to Africa." And I take that dramatic pause to revision, re-see, re-energize where we need to go. And so I have some key things that I think are positional within the story. But honestly, I might talk to one person that says to me, my child loves dancing bears. And I'll think, what'll I know about dancing bears? Well, I do know a story about a dancing polar bear. And I may tell that tonight. It's the most requested story that I tell. And I hear Sash wants me to tell that. But it's called When Did Polar Bears Learn to Dance? And it's based off the life of William Blake. But you won't know that unless I tell you that story.
I heard you tell that in Arkansas.
Oh, you did too? Okay.
I told that at the festival I had in Arkansas.
It's a fun story.
Yes.
It is, and it's an imaginative story. Now, when I first started as a storyteller, I'm like, these moments have to follow these moments all the time and in this way.
But I'm literally finding places to play inside the story, in the telling of the actual process with the audience. So I make a lot more choices of risk when I'm telling stories. Even, oh, dare I say it to storytellers, I might break the story to find a moment to build another moment. And that's a sin. And just call me a crook. It's all right. You know, honestly, we need to make more choices that are risky, and we need to break. We need to know the traditional rules, and we need to follow them when they're in suit. But sometimes it comes back to that. It's contextual, social, personal, and it invests this moment that it needs something else, and we need to answer it when it needs something else.
Well, that reminds me of a question that I had yesterday from a parent who just casually mentioned in passing that she was going to bring her grandchildren to Stories in the Round tomorrow. And I reminded her that our publicity materials always say, no matter who our teller is, that in a really pompous statement that's included there on the brochure, children 12 years and older, welcome when accompanied by parent or adult group leader. And so I wanted to ask you about that. Do you have any advice for parents, grandparents, or children themselves, and for the pompous coordinators of storytelling venues?
First, it's not pompous at all. It's a place where 12 and older aren't going to hear stories that much, and you're creating a really wonderful space so that it can happen. And second, there are a number of places. There are not enough places for kids to tell stories, but there's more. I would say on the immediacy, it's okay. Bring the younger kids in tonight. Mm-hmm. It's fine. But here's the deal, and this is something storytellers wrestle all the time. You have 400 in the audience, or you have 300 in the audience, and you have two kids that are four and under. I've heard a number of storytellers say, what'll I do? What'll I do? And I've heard one side say, well, I can only tell for the four and under, but it was clearly marked, but you're missing the other 400 who came for a different reason. So you might have to have a compassionate talk that says, hey, these stories might not be for four and under. I just need to let you know, but you're making the choice. But, you know, for the immediacy of tonight, I think they're going to be fine. But we need to have those spaces that we can say, hey, this is a story about loss. This is a story about grief. This is a story about laughing in a different way that only an adult knows. Whether it's a first date or a wrong date or an experience that you would never tell a seven-year-old. We need those spaces. We need to break that barrier that says that story is only for the really, really young kids. We need to have the place. Well, think of all the money that we invest for someone to tell a story to us on a couch. Or we invest in so much money of, you know, hey, I just want to be heard. Adults need those places to tell the story. Again, for the immediacy, bring those kids. That's fine. I'm going to look out in the audience. I literally say that, you know, kids' stories defy ages, all right? Whether I'm talking about a dragon who can't breathe fire because he can only breathe blue smoke through his nose, whatever. but then there's those times that, like tonight, I might tell a story about Vietnam, about someone I met. And so I, as a storyteller, have a responsibility to go up to that parent and say, I just want you to know I'll be telling this kind of story. It's okay for you to leave during this time, but I have to tell for the whole audience, and I can't cater to just two. But I really appreciate you, and here's some places that you can go, and here's some things that you can do. But usually, sometimes I bow and say, oh, wow, I'll just do a story that's for all ages. It's a hard thing. It really is. But there's also a different type of seven-year-old for someone who's been going to storytelling all the time and then someone who isn't. So checking in with the parents, they might just be in a state of readiness. And this person who called, these kids might be in a state of readiness. But it's good to check in. It's good to check in with everyone. And so we need to have more places where kids 12 and years and under, that there's a cautionary note. But they can't yell at us if a story didn't meet that match of the age that they thought it should be when they've been cautioned not to. Wait, let me get the phone. That might be that parent right now. Hello.
Thank you, Kevin. What I love about your answer is that you made us all heroes in that story and all advocates for story.
Well, believe it or not, our hour has gone. So this is Stasia Olkowski.
And Fanny Crawford.
And
Kevin Cordy. Play on.
Your tri-host for today's New Time Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. Independent community radio from Bolivar, West Virginia. Signing off at the end of our hour today. The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our stories. Join us next week, same time, same URL for more storytelling. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for
Rock and Roll Poetry.
Rock and Roll Poetry.
You can also go to our podcast at talltales.enlightenradio.org. See you next week.
Surround yourself with story.